Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. There's a series of events happening on the Utah Tech University campus in St. George. It's under the title of Remember the 43 Students. Commemorates the six people who were killed and the 43 students who were forcibly disappeared in a night of unspeakable political violence in Iguala, Guerrero State, Mexico on September 26, 2014. And so this year is the 10th anniversary of that atrocity. Utah Tech University presents the 4th annual campus engagement to memorialize those lost souls and the at least 105,000 more Mexican citizens who've been forcibly disappeared since 2006. And as a part of these events, on Monday, they'll have a screening of the film 43, A Contemporary Requiem. That's at 6 p.m. in the Dunford Auditorium on the Utah Tech campus. The film documents the 2016 creation of the Music and Dance Requiem, which commemorates the 43 and all victims of political violence. Then on Tuesday, musicians Andre Solis and Scott Hanna-Weir discuss the atrocity and their creative process in creating the live music and dance performance, 43, Contemporary Requiem. That's 4 p.m. on Tuesday in the Zion Room. Their talk is titled 10 Years After Ayotzinapa, Despair, Memorials, and Art. So we do welcome in Andre Solis, a composer and musician. Andres, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you very much for inviting us and letting us talk about this very special project.
Am I getting your name right? Is it Solis?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, okay. Solis, yeah. All right. Scott Hanna-Weir is associate professor and director of choral activities at Santa Clara University. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's really my pleasure to be here and to be with Andres as well. We had such an amazing time being able to collaborate back in 2016, and so it's wonderful to revisit this work.
So let's, I guess, just right at the beginning, I'd reference this a little bit. I don't know which of you wants to talk about this. I'll maybe throw it to Andres first. Tell us a little bit more about those events, this atrocity, September 26, 2014.
Well, I mean, since long time ago, there's been lots of very similar violence in Mexico. We've been dealing with this for many, many years now. But I think this was like a breaking point, you know. What happened 10 years ago, it was basically unbelievable, you know, because most of the violence has always been related to drug dealing and some other political stuff that went on since late 1960s with the student movements. But after that, there was like some kind of peace or a truce between, you know, the government and students. And for many years, there was like some relative calm, you know, and all this violence that has been going around, political and social violence in Mexico, didn't involve like innocent people for many years, you know. Well, of course it did in some cases, but not at this degree, you know. So, you know, 10 years ago on this very tragical day, the news started to come up with very little information at the beginning, you know, that, well, you know, the news, it was like, well, there's been some violence in Iguala, in this place called Ayotzinapa. And then a few hours later, and well, you know, there are some missing students, and it all started to flow very very gradually. But I think, at least in my experience, like maybe 2 or 3 days after, everybody around me started to realize how big this thing was. And then when everything came up, like the authorities really just came out to accept that 43 students were disappeared, well, it was absolutely shocking. And from there on, when the all the events started to come out at the light and all the details, then it was just simply unbelievable, you know. And then basically at a political level, it was also very, very very important, and it actually, I could say, changed the course of the political course of Mexico since. So from 10 years, this has been like the break point of, you know, realizing that this has to stop. And the bad news is that it doesn't. We're still getting all these huge numbers of violent victims, and yeah, and it's terrible. But that was it.
Yeah. Scott Hanawir, what? How did you discover this? How did you come to this?
Well, you know, I had certainly heard some about the news of this event tangentially, but I didn't really begin to fully understand and appreciate the tragedy of these events and to really understand them until I began collaborating with Andres. I think it's the unfortunate byproduct of, you know, being relatively isolated in a country that is mostly stable, and that these kinds of events don't always percolate out to our own experiences, but being able to hear about these events and learn about them from perspective of Andres and then learn about his desire to create a piece around this, you know, really helped me start to contextualize what a complete tragedy and how far beyond the violence that had sort of been occurring at the time this event was. And for us to really take a moment to say, we really need to make more people aware of this. And that can often be the power of art to be able to engage people with topics like this, where they could then have an emotional and response that's not just hearing about the news, but they can actually make a connection to the what the event was, what the significance of the event was, what it means. So it was really through working on this piece that I got a much better understanding of the events.
I want to follow up on that, Scott Hanawir, and then get Andres's thoughts on this. So awareness, you say that's at least one way that art can assist here, awareness, and I guess bring emotional impact to something.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think there's a lot of music that does this, and, you know, in my own compositions as well, I'm primarily a choral conductor, but I write music as well, primarily for choirs. And I think my experience has been that sometimes taking topics that audiences might only expect to go to a lecture about or read about in journalism, and being able to create a piece of art around it allows folks to then create this emotional connection that impacts them in a very deeply felt way, so that when they are then learning about it in more of an intellectual space, they're able to connect with it, not just in sort of that academic perspective, but also in a way that they feel. And I think that creates a deeper level of understanding and appreciation for the topic. And I think it often compel folks to feel like there's more urgency to do something about it, to share that with others because of the impact that it had on them. And that's not to say that, you know, like other forms of learning about of events or information is not valuable, of course, especially alongside these kinds of artistic creations. But I think being able to create a emotional response, as you were saying, to an event or to a circumstance or to a news story or to a topic, I think it often creates such a more powerful connection for someone who's learning about it. And so I think that's one of the real benefits of art that has social justice or social impact themes.
Andres Julius, I want to get your perspective on this. What the role of art in engaging people to looking for solutions, or at least engaging with really difficult social issues, including atrocities such as this?
Yes, I mean, definitely, as Scott says, and get everyone involved and engaged through emotions, I think it's one of the most powerful things that art can contribute to these issues, because of course there are many, many solutions. You know, it's not that just by composing a piece or writing a text or doing a painting, you are giving like a concrete solution to these things. But you create this collective consciousness at a very deep level, and that has to do with emotions, of course. And I think that's one of the most powerful things that art can put on the table to kind of fix and try to get all this terrible events not to repeat in sometimes at some points. But yeah, I think that's the most important thing of art getting involved in this. Because as I said, there are many other solutions that are more concrete and maybe at a political level, and legal and justice system has to do with more tangible things. But definitely without the presence of this kind of expressions through art, I think it's much more difficult to permeate all these ideas into the collectiveness of society.
Let me start this one with Andres Solis. So 2015, I understand, you and choreographer Sandra Milena Gomez Andres Solis, with Sandra Milena Gomez, started thinking about doing a new piece. Did you immediately focus on the 43?
Yes, Sandra is my wife, and we've worked together well for many years now, and I think that most of our projects are always related to at some point to some social issues, and so we kind of always try to go through that direction. And from the very beginning, when I mean, all this begun when Santa Clara University and the Montalvo Art Center commissioned us this piece. You know, they said, "Well, you can collaborate with the university to do, well, basically whatever you want." But since Sandra and I have been involved in this social issues for many years, and this was very recent, maybe some months after the tragedy came up, we felt very overwhelmed with the situation, and we wanted to do something and contribute somehow to engage people on the importance of what just happened. And yeah, from the very beginning, we sat down and we said, okay, what can we do to kind of take this into light and through our forms of expression? And we decided to do something. At the very beginning, we were not very sure if it was going to be a requiem, but we knew that it was something to do with music and dance. And then after, you know, thinking a little bit about it, we came up with the idea of the Requiem. We did the proposal to the University of Santa Clara, where Stephen Lee, that's where we met him. And I think from the very beginning, the idea came up with the impact that we were expecting. So everyone involved started to get very serious about it, and that's how it all started.
So I want to follow up, Andres. So you're composing the music, Sandra's doing the choreography. It's kind of like you know, with a song, music and lyrics. So what comes first, or is it just interactive, the music or the dance?
Well, in this case in particular, it was the music came up first because of the distance. We didn't have a chance to work with Scott and the choir of Santa Clara, you know, at the same time with the choreographers. So what we did was actually, I always say that this piece was co-composed with Scott, because it was a very close collaboration with him, in which I would send basically every note I would, I'm sorry, I would write, I would send, you know, maybe one bar or two or even less to Scott, and he would give me feedback and say, well, you know, this will work much better this way, because he knows very well his choir and all the people there. So we both started to build up the music before, and Sandra came up as I was writing the music with Scott. Sandra was, you know, like coming up with images. She always thinks her choreographies with a kind of a like a storyboard of a film storyboard. And so she thinks like on how the bodies will be moving in the space, like having some snapshots of it. And she came with these ideas without listening to the music, because the first time she listened to the music was on the first day of rehearsal, many, many months after we started the process, you know. But she, in this particular case, she started to work on the choreography without having the notion of the musical and the sound that was going to be you know, involved in the choreography, you know.
Very interesting. So Scott, tell me about your involvement. You're I know you're a composer yourself, but in this case you're working with a composer. He's sending you bars of music, and then what do you do with that?
Yeah, well, it's an amazing and slightly unusual collaborative process that Andres and I were able to have. A lot of times, you know, and I've done many premieres of composers and of new works, and they often go a couple of different ways. You know, sometimes you might be commissioning that composer and have some themes or ideas or sort of a musical world that you're hoping that they might be willing to inhabit, and you're giving them some guidance or maybe even giving them a text, and then they're writing that piece for your ensemble, knowing sort of the limitations of your group, and then come back with a piece that you say, oh, this is really great. And maybe you feel empowered to say like one or two things like, I wonder if in this measure we could do something slightly different. But as Andres said, this was much more, he would send me a bit of it and I would say, well, I think for the same kind of effect, we might be able to do this kind of thing, which would be a little bit simpler for the choir to be able to pull off and probably more effective. Or I think like this works really great. Or have you considered like this phrase? And a lot of composers would not be very excited about hearing that from the choral conductor who they are going to be working with. But Andres was so generous and completely collaborative and came into the process with really no ego at all, and just wanted to make a piece that would be incredibly successful and compelling. And that was also my approach, that I wanted to really try to help Andres be able to find the sound world and the voice that he wanted, and then make it the most successful choral piece it could be. And I think because we had that close working relationship, it really was an amazing outcome that I think the piece works incredibly well, and was able to be accomplished. Because part of what was challenging about the creation of this work, Andres already mentioned the distance, right? That Andres was writing from Mexico and not here and able to work with the choir very often. The choir's timeline for the performance was also very compacted, because we were able to work on it a little bit in the fall, and then we premiered it in January. But Santa Clara is on the quarter system, so we have a huge gap in December where we're not in session, where the students weren't able to continue to work on the piece. And so we had very limited rehearsal time, so we had to have a piece that was as complex and interesting as what Andres was able to create, but also accomplishable within the time frame. And so we were always sort of thinking about like, how can we make sure that artistic vision comes to life in a really successful way that's also pragmatic and works within the logistical frameworks that we have. And I feel like we didn't end up having to compromise that artistic vision given the parameters, which is always exciting in a collaboration where you feel like you're really able to do the work justice, the vision of the work justice. And, you know, I had composed a fair amount prior to this, and so I had a little bit of that lens, but also I think like Andres's writing and that collaborative back and forth really changed the way I think about my own composition and the way that I work with other composers afterwards. So it was a pretty catalytic event for me in my sort of creative output life as well. So that was a real pleasure. The other thing I would say is that Andres mentioned that the choreography was sort of built from, sort of moments or tableaus or pictures. And I think there was a large aspect of this work that was very much about the space that the work was going to be in. We were Andres and Sandra had been able to tour the Mission Santa Clara, which is the mission that's on the campus of Santa Clara University. And that's the normal performing environment for our choirs there and for many of our musical ensembles and of course an active church as well. And it's a beautiful space, really resonant, a giant rectangular prism that is very flexible because all the chairs are able to be moved. And so I think a lot of the vision for the work also came from sort of thinking about that space, the organ that's there, the sound of choir in a space like that. And so I think when you have a lens like that, that you're looking at the compositional process through, that also helps clarify what the goals are. And so made it a little bit simpler and more focused for us to be able to really try to find our way as we were working to bring that piece to life.
Well, so before we go to a break, I want to have us get a little taste of this. 43, A Contemporary Requiem. I've got the film in front of me here, and hopefully I've queued it up well. We'll see here, but we get a little taste of this music. That's a very powerful. So just kind of for the scene, for those who can't see it, is in the background, there's the choir. On the sides, it appears to be the audience. In the middle, a single dancer. Very but anything you want to say about that particular section, Andres? From the beginning of the Requiem.
I mean, as Scott says, the space was very, very important in the whole process. And that's Sandra, one of the things that she had clear even before that I started writing the music was the space, because we went before to know the campus and where everything was going to be. So she already had like some idea of where she was going to be moving. And I think that was a result of her being really clear on how she understands space. And of course, we didn't have at the very beginning how the staging was going to be at the end, And we didn't have very clear that where the choir was going to be, but she knew that she wanted to have as much space as possible. So that's why we realized that maybe the best thing was to have some kind of circle that all the action would happen in the center instead of, like an Italian theater, which is usually what regular theater looks like, where you have the audience on one side of the space, and then stage is in front, and then everything happens, what's called the fourth wall, and that's it, you know. In this way, we decided to take the action in the center, precisely to engage with the entire space and the audience as well, you know, to make it part of the experience. And I think that's one of the most important things that make this visual impact of having the space like this, and having at the very beginning only one dancer moving in the space, like starting to build up this the drama of the scene, you know. So yeah, that's basically it.
Well, we're overdue for a break. Let's take a break. We're talking on Access U today with Andres Solis, composer and musician, and Scott Hanna-Weir, associate professor and director of choral activities at Santa Clara University. They're both involved in a requiem, a piece of music and a dance. It's called 43, a Contemporary Requiem. And the film of that will be screened on Monday on the Utah Tech campus, 6 p.m. Dunford Auditorium, as a part of remembering the 43 events at Utah Tech University. And then they'll have a talk about that, about putting together this, what we're talking about today. That talk is called 10 Years After Iutzinapa: Despair, Memorials, and Art. And that'll be on the Utah Tech campus as well. These events are free and open to the public. Just trying to pull this up to see the details of that talk. That'll be in the Zion Room on Tuesday, 4 p.m. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Remember the 43 Students is a series of events at Utah Tech University. It commemorates the six people who were killed and 43 students who were forcibly disappeared in a night of unspeakable political violence in Iguala, Guerrero State, Mexico, on September 26, 2014. This year is the 10th anniversary of that atrocity, and Utah Tech University is presenting their fourth annual campus engagement. There will be art installations and other events. Those art installations, I think, are available beginning tomorrow and running for about a month. And as a part of this, on Monday, 6 p.m. in the Dunford Auditorium on the Utah Tech campus, there'll be a screening of the film 43, A Contemporary Requiem. The film documents the creation of Music and Dance Requiem, which commemorates the 43 and all victims of political violence. Then on Tuesday, September 17th, 4 p.m., in the Zion Room on the Utah Tech campus, musicians Andres Solis and Scott Hanna-Weir discuss the atrocity in their creative process in creating that live music and dance performance. And we have with us for the hour today the composer and musician Andres Solis and Scott Hanna-Weir, associate professor and director of choral activities at Santa Clara a University. I want to hear just a little bit more from this requiem, so we'll pull up the film again, and I've just sort of gone randomly later in this requiem to set the scene here. Now we have several dancers. That first piece just featured one dancer. The choir in the background, the audience on the sides here. So let's just hear a bit more from 43, A Contemporary Requiem. So there's just a bit more of 43, A Contemporary Requiem. Scott Hanauer, we heard organ there. We've got dancers, of course, the choir, electronic music, understand, even some stagecraft. A lot going on in this piece. So maybe talk just a little bit about putting all of that together. I'll get Andres's ideas on that afterwards as well.
Yeah, it's an exciting challenge to bring a work like that together. And it's not a thing that, you know, every choir member, especially, you know, undergraduate choral singer who's coming to Santa Clara University, often not to major in music necessarily, but, you know, we have probably as many engineers in our choir as we have music majors, for sure. And these are students who have always really enjoyed music and often worked on it at a high level, and they wanted to keep it up in college, but maybe it's not their initial focus. And so when you tell them the second week of the winter quarter, we're going to be premiering this work for dance, choir, electronics, and organ, that could be a bit overwhelming for the students, I think. But you could also scaffold all of that and help them figure out the ways to be successful. And so we had spent a lot of time as the choir alone, really trying to wrap our heads around the musical language and doing everything that we could to be able to be successful when we started putting all of the elements together. Now, Andres had mentioned that the choreography was created sort of in some ways separately from the music. And so one of my greatest concerns was when we were in the week of rehearsals that was leading up to the performance, how much did we need to coordinate the dance and the music, which I would be conducting. And to my great relief, I just sort of made the music happen and the dance happened in response and in conversation with the music. And it works really amazingly. I think a lot of times if we think about dance, we're thinking of it as a very rhythmic and fixed thing that has coordination specifically with an individual moment in the music, and then three beats later this thing happens. And that's not really how the choreography and the music interact in this piece, and it ends up feeling a lot more organic. Not that it's improvised, but it has that sort of spontaneity and presence in the moment that I think can sometimes be really hard to create in dance. And so that's something that was really compelling for me. Of course, I didn't get to see the dance until I watched the film, because my back was to it the entire time as I was conducting the choir and the organ. The organist came in only for those last few rehearsals, and so they had worked on the repertoire on their own. And then, you know, Andres and I met with Jim Welch, who was our organist for that performance, and worked on several of the movements to make sure that we had a corporate understanding of it, and then tried to put that all together. And the good news is that Andres was performing the electronics and was relatively familiar with the piece, obviously. So he was able to just sort of fit in seamlessly. And the electronics that he created very much supported what the choir was doing, and helped in many ways keep the choir on track, which sometimes that's not the case. Sometimes when you have electronic components to a piece, that's the thing that the choir goes, okay, I'm just going to try to not think about that while I do my thing. But actually, Andres's electronics were incredibly supportive and filled out a lot of what the choir was doing. And so it was pretty remarkable how it was able to all come together. I mean, we had a lot of careful planning that we had sort of executed to be able to make that happen, thinking about what the rehearsal schedule would be, when we would be able to do various different things, what the plan was in terms of making it through the work. But then bringing all of those elements together, performing in an unusual configuration of the church, having theatrical lighting, having the choreography that was happening. Of course, the students who were singing in the choir could see the choreography the whole time, so they had to remember to actually continue to sing and not just be distracted by the incredible dance. So there were a lot of things for us to consider, but the impetus of the importance of the work, I think, really kept us all focused through the process. And even though I think some of the members of the ensemble might have been skeptical that we could put this all together when we started, I think everybody was just so completely impressed by the work and its totality. And it's really a work that functions best in this sort of total way, that you need an environment and the electronics and the dance and the organ and the choir. Like, excerpting sections of it doesn't have the same impact as the entire work being one event like this, with the other contextualizing events that we did on campus as well, that it wasn't just about that. There was the art installation of the 43 silhouettes, which will be on display at Utah Tech as well. And so there were a number of things that all came together to make this event as meaningful and powerful as it ended up being. And so I think at the end, the students and I and Jim, our organist, and we all felt really very, very proud to have been a part of putting it together.
Andres Tullis, I want to read a bit from your bio here to have you apply this to this piece and beyond if you want. Andres Tullis is a composer and sound artist. His work is often focused on exploring free musical forms that intend to dilute the rigid constraints imposed by traditional music structures. He sought to assimilate his environment, to find his own language through computer-assisted composition, improvisation, interdisciplinary artistic collaboration. Now, this is certainly an interdisciplinary artistic collaboration. Did any of the rest of that enter in here? There's so many elements here, including electronic music.
Yes, as Scott said, it was not only the music itself, but all these other disciplines came together and make the entire piece so powerful, I think. And I've always thought that the more expressions that you are able to work with, the more opportunities to express that you have. For example, trying to work with electronics is not just because it's on fashion or because technology, we have to be up to date with the technology and all these things. But I think of electronics, for example, as if it was, in this case, as if it was one more voice of the choir, for example. And I try to kind of blend every idea I have in my sound imagination, try to blend with everything else, like as for example the way my wife thinks of choreography with this kind of images, and she thinking about herself moving in the space, I can try to feel the same with any other element of the entire piece. It might be the sound, but in some cases it might be something related to staging or lighting, or maybe the space itself. So I kind of try to link everything into my own sound imagination. I'm not sure if I'm clear with these ideas, but yeah, that's a bit of how I think music in many cases. I mean, I don't always compose the same way. It depends on the kind of project I'm working on, but in this case, it was very much like that.
I want to talk to each of you about the focus of your talk at Utah Tech. Of course, there'll be a screening of the film, 43, A Contemporary Requiem, 6 p.m. in the Dunford Auditorium on Utah Tech campus. That's Monday, September 16th. Then on Tuesday, September 17th, 4 p.m. in the Zion Room on the Utah Tech campus, the two of you will discuss the 43 atrocity and the creative process. The title is interesting. I'll start with Scott Hennaweer on this. 10 years after Ayotzinapa, Despair, Memorials, and Art. So tell me a little bit about your talk, Scott Hennaweer.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we're touching on some of the themes that we've been talking about today. And I think particularly the importance of the way that art responds to important events. And the role of the artist in terms of being able to focus the eyes of society on things that we should look at more closely. As we already mentioned, I think like the power of artists to be able to create an emotional response or to impact with an audience member or the performers or the collaborators who are involved in the project is really important. And I think is a key focus for both Andres and I as artists. But I think, you know, one of the things that it also makes me think about is the fact that there's lots of events that happen throughout our lives that sort of make us wonder, like, what are we doing to work towards the betterment of the world? And I think there have been many times where I've questioned, well, I'm a choral conductor. You know, I do a lot of contemporary music, but I'm primarily preserving a pretty old tradition, and doing music from centuries ago sometimes. And how do I, in my job, work for the betterment of the world? And we could talk about how, you know, being involved in art is beneficial from a mental health perspective. It creates community with the people who are involved in it. How the creation of art and the appreciation of art help us open up our human spirit and make us more whole people. I think all of that is important, but I think it's also something that I've thought about in terms of what can I do within my profession to work for that. Those goals of bettering the world or speaking out about injustice and oppression, and making art like this is one of the ways within what I do that I can actually do something. Because I think sometimes we may feel compelled to go out and do things that are not the things that we normally do, and I to fight against oppression and violence. And I think that that can also be good, but that can also be very challenging when we have our lives spent so much by filled by the careers and passions that we've been pursuing for decades. And so I think it's an example of ways that all of us can think about where is the space within the things that we are already doing, where we can take an approach that recognizes injustice and oppression and tries to move the needle in a positive direction. So I think that's one component beyond just this specific piece or the way that art itself creates a space for us to be able to engage with complicated topics in an emotional way, that there's also sort of the introspective part for someone like me of like, how do I make sure that I'm also making a difference, right? And thinking about ways to contextualize that kind of work in my own career and creative life. So that's certainly one aspect. And I think the other thing that we're certainly going to be talking about from my perspective is that the ability to create with other people and the power that it has to make something greater than what you would do alone. And the challenge it creates when you're doing it with other people. I mean, I think we could all think back to school and the joy of a group project and whether or not that's something that we all are excited about. And however, you know, when collaboration goes like it did with Andres, the end result is something better than it could ever be if any one of us had tried to just do it on our own. The fact that there were so many of us at this in this project, our choir, me, Andres, Sandra, Steve, from sort of a production standpoint, thinking about the lighting, also our videographer, you know, there were so many folks who were involved in thinking about the creative process and trying to bring their best foot forward and to lift up each other and to contribute ideas and move us in different directions than we might have taken individually. And I think that could take time and be messy, but the ending result of that can be so incredible. And I think it's such an allegory for the way that working together with others can really lift up each of us individually and create something that's more powerful than what we could ever do alone. And I think that kind of collective action is what's necessary in terms of working against injustice in the world. So it's a good model for the way that that could actually play out in society.
Andres Solis, we just have about a minute left. I'll give you the last word here. What do you hope people take away from the film and from your talk and everything we've been talking about today?
Well, yeah, about I think I would just close by saying that this collectiveness that Scott talked about is one of the most important elements in the entire project. All the people involved that helped materializing everything, you know, that from the art installation, the music, the choreography, etc. I think that's one of the most important things on this particular project. You know, that it was not like a single artist just trying to say something, which is also very valid and in many cases might be as powerful. But in this case, the collaboration between all the people that was involved is what makes this so a very deep and compelling piece of work, I think.
Well, thanks.
And
Yeah.
Tom, if I may say the following for those people who can't attend the film screening on September 16th, they can go into the website, which is rememberthe43students.com, and there's a link to the film. The Remember the 43 Students is 43 with number, so remember the 43 with numbers students.com, and they can find a link to the film to anyone who can't attend on the screening on the 16th.
All right, so very good. And we have a link to that overall site, to remember the 43students.com, on our website, upr.org. So Monday, September 16th, screening of the film, 43 Contemporary Requiem, 6 p.m. Dunford Auditorium on the Utah Tech campus. Tuesday, September 17th, 4 p.m. in the Zion Room. Our guests today, Andres Solis and Scott Hanna-Weir, will give a talk. So we very much appreciate composer and musician Andres Solis joining us. Andres, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Tom.
And Scott Hanna-Weir, Associate Professor and Director of Choral Activities at Santa Clara University. Thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah Today. We'll go out as we do on Thursdays with Leo T. and Skywatcher.
It's many cultures, one sky. Skywatcher Leo T here as we look up as the stars come out in the purple twilight. The great dim square of Pegasus is climbing the eastern sky, looking forward above bright Jupiter and a bit to the left. It's balancing on one corner like the horse likes to do. Late these nights, ever brightening Mars is back, accentuating the eastern sky, hanging on the horn of Taurus the bull. It's the same color as Aldebaran, the eye of the bull to its right. Check the neat chart from Sky and Telescope on the Skywatcher Facebook page. And way out into the distance, we can see NASA's DART probe getting ready to play cosmic pool and connect with an asteroid September 26th. The Double Asteroid Redirection Test is a bold attempt to knock an incoming space rock out of its trajectory, as scientists are hoping to be able to knock an asteroid out of a possible collision course if it is coming toward the Earth. That's where DART's cosmic pool game comes in. The spacecraft will slam into a small asteroid called Dimorphos, which, like clockwork, orbits a larger near-Earth asteroid called Didymos. It's kind of a moon of an asteroid. By targeting one of the two asteroids, scientists can see the orbit of both and see relatively if the impact knocked Dimorphos out of its orbit. By the way, it's not going to hit the Earth. They're just practicing. And NASA has been a busy space agency, haven't they? With space telescope probes to Jupiter and out beyond the solar system. And, of course, the project to put people back on the moon again called Artemis. And the uncrewed launch that will test the systems out around and beyond the moon is on the launch pad, as NASA announced Monday evening. It will delay the fuel system test of the massive rocket following repairs to fueling components performed last week aimed at addressing recurring liquid hydrogen fuel leaks. The fueling test has been moved to the 21st of September and now looking to launch the Artemis 1 mission on the 27th of September and reviewing October 2nd as a potential backup date. They have some other windows as well, so go Artemis, go! And winging for the moon. Out to Mars, JPL and NASA's Perseverance rover is snapping some great shots. You can see this one on the Skywatcher site. It's an image of the Enchanted Lake rocky outcrop. There's not really a lake there, but there was once. It's informally named after a landmark in Alaska's Katmai National Park. The image of the outcrop near the base of Jezero Craters Delta, where the rover is roving around, provided the rover team with a close-up glimpse of sedimentary rocks. Such rocks consist of fine particles carried by the atmosphere and water, and deposited in generally flat-laying layers, which become indurated or turned into rock over time. It's Many Cultures, One Sky. Big thanks to Anthony Aveni, Star Stories, with a little fun and interpretation by your storyteller, Skywatcher. Do you ever lie on the grass on a hot summer day? You have probably gazed at puffy cumulus clouds rolling in a deep blue sky and imagined familiar forms morphing from one to another. A bird that, as you watch, turns into a dragon. And then into your cat's face. We do the same with geological formations, New Hampshire's Old Man of the Mountain, the Woman of Mali in Guinea, and an extraterrestrial face on the surface of Mars. Remember that one? Once the cumulus clouds evaporate in the evening twilight and pitch black sky and mysterious points of light start appearing, there's another backdrop, very suitable for expressing the narrative of the hunt or planting. Stars and swirls of sparkling light arc slowly and silently across the night sky. The night sky is a natural storyboard available to everyone. Ptolemy, a 2nd century Alexandrian astronomer, listed 48 constellations, 3 dozen which were named after land animals, fish and birds, with a sprinkling of snakes and humanoids, as well as one insect. But everyone who has lived or is living has looked at puffy or lenticular clouds, geologic formations, or in the night sky, patterns and shapes in the stars. The emu in the sky, from Aboriginal Australia to Peru, where the Villacanata River leads back to the skies, the Milky Way. Tacitus the whale swimming in the southern celestial seas, with Delphinus the dolphin up above jumping in and out of the Milky Way. The sky, it's all of our heritage. So keep looking up, look around, and get a little bit lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.